characteristic structure. So first of all, principal node direction is the most well-known and pretty much the only used part of the characteristic structure. Analyze the important things like Peeling theorem, the patch of classification, also as I show here, important for scattering waves. Just having an intuitive feel what it is helpful. And characteristic structure is gauge invariant. It's like a matrix. When you write it in its principal basis, the eigenvectors, it doesn't matter what initial basis you use to express the matrix. So it's very useful for numerical relativity in that sense. So you can extract gauge invariant quantities from the study, from the data. And then there's the analogy. I'll try to draw some analogy with second fundamental form because the name principal direction is obviously already leads you in that direction. Might as well just, you know, formulate one, an analogy. And that would allow to borrow ideas from surface theory to use in gravity. In particular, the principal null directions, I'll show how they behave in scattering and why when you follow like degenerate principal null directions, there's less of a scattering. And also build up analogy as a second fundamental form, and this to show that despite the name, it's actually more like the asymptotic direction rather than the principal direction. And then also you can go on to find the true principal directions, and then these are basically not used, but if you look at surface theory, the principal directions are very useful. Their integral curves are called lines of curvature, and you can prove a lot of mathematical theorems on that thing, and they link the geometry of the surface to its topology and everything. So this is all not used in gravity yet, but it's pretty straightforward, I think, to just port them over. And I'll try to go through some utilizations for these things, see how far I go. I think I have more slides than 1 hour. So the motivating factor for studying the scattering behavior comes from reading this paper by Brendan Grell and Jacobson. So they found a bunch of null solutions for force free electrodynamics. So this is the counterpart to Robinson's null solutions for vacuum EM. So basically, force free, you have very tenuous plasma whose stress energy tensor is can be neglected as compared to the stress energy of the EM field itself. So what's a null solution? Null solution is defined by the property of having two principal null directions of the EM field tensor being identical to each other, which mathematically leads you to a vanishing invariance of the EM curvature tensor, which is the second line here, which is also equivalent to this two equations, which shows the E field has the same magnitude as B, and they're locally orthogonal to each other. So obviously it looks like a plane wave locally, and it is indeed a pure radiative solution. There's no Coulomb background part, and there's no oppositely moving part, which just means the wave somehow avoid being scattered by space-time curvature, and that's pretty much the reason why you can actually write this thing out in a closed form solution. If it scatters everywhere like crazy, then it'll be a lot harder to solve them mathematically. So these kind of solutions are, first of all, mathematically important in their relationships to, for example, twisters. So the propagation directions of these null solutions, they form what's called a Robinson congruence. And the twister, for example, you have null twisters, which is basically two spinners, which corresponds to a null vector, or a null geodesic, in the sense that one of the spinners gives you the direction of the ray, and the other one gives you where it intersects a null cone at origin, so basically fix that particular null ray for you. And then you have the non-null twisters, which is due to the null twisters through some incident relationship, which is an algebraic relationship, and there's a whole congruence of them, of null rays incident with one particular non-null twister, and they form a Robinson congruence. And this transformation into the twister space is very useful for calculating stuff in flat space time, like in quantum field theory or something. And then astrophysically, it's also important, this null solutions, because, for example, the ones that in force free, electrodynamics can be used to model outer magnetosphere of a pulsar, you know, how to transport energy through the environment. As I said, their simplicity owes to their ability of being able to avoid being strongly scattered by space-time. By strongly scattered, I mean the kind of scatter that doesn't introduce oppositely moving wave component. As you can, as I'll discuss later, they are actually scattered, but the scattering is of a simplified form. So first of all, why are the waves generically scattered? Because the field tensor is a tensor, and this component we usually use is E and B, they're the vectors. So they couple those space-time curvature through Ricci identity. If you swap the covariant derivatives, you get an extra term multiplying with the curvature tensor. So if you have a point source, it shoots out a null cone, and then the ray going on the null cone will scatter against the background curvature and then come back in. So you get, so they travel inside the null cone as well, so have wave everywhere. So they don't satisfy the usual geometric optics theorems. You can find these scattering terms explicitly by writing out the wave equation for the field tensor. The first three terms on the right-hand side, they're scattering by space-time curvature. This one obviously comes from the Ricci identity. And the second line is scattering by the charging current. We only consider a vacuum case, so this Ricci part is ignored. So a hint of why they avoid scattering is provided by the fact that they must follow shear free null congruencies and Gover Stack theorem says such congruencies must be tangential to repeated space-time principal null directions, degenerate ones. No. Oh, right. So I haven't specialized to any particular. This is a general statement. There's a theorem that says if you have shear free null congruency, you always have at least vacuum. That.
I just wonder where the statement of Popke is not shear free null congruencies came from. Null. Why shear free? Oh, because of electromagnetics.
Right. So shear free. We'll see later. Shear free is a property of the principal null directions, like multiple principal null directions there, and you'll see this makes.
Do all solutions in that equation propagate along shear free null congruences, or is that a special?
The null solutions that the scatter has to,
solutions.
Yeah. Otherwise, you can just shoot anything initially and then just slot wrong.
Yes, the reason why, because if it's DA,
right.
Yeah,
Right. So yeah, for these solutions, they have to do this. So basically, you can see that principal null directions play an important role in this whole null scattering scheme. And you can see this pretty much only in the spinner formalism. Unfortunately, the tensor formalism is it's so convolved that that the whole reason why people use the term principal null directions rather than asymptotic directions, probably because they use the tensor formalism to start with, which looks like a characteristic equation, but that really isn't. but anyhow, if you look at Wikipedia, people actually give you impression that way. But if you write in the spinner formalism, a spinner is basically a square root of a null vector, if you want to think of that way. So a spinner, iota A and iota bar A prime, this compact conjugation maps into a space-time null vector LA through what's called a soldering form, a sigma thing. And then if you have a spinner dyad, it would generate a Newman-Penrose null tetrad, again, by mapping through this, this soldering form. And this soldering form is basically, I can never pronounce that German name, right, from an orthogonal tetrad to a coordinate tetrad. Which means if your A, index A, is decomposition against the orthonormal tetrad image, your metric is just Minkowski, then this solar uniforms, they're just SU2 generators. But in general, for a coordinate system in which your metric is non-trivial, all the metric information is stored in disguise. Which you can see from this map between the space-time metric to the to basically the metric in the spinner space. All the non-trivial information is here. This guy is the constant by spinners, and they're anti-symmetric, which means if you contract a spinner with itself, you get zero, which is befitting for their role of being the square root of a null vector. And then these things relate directly to the complexified tensors. For example, if you do anti-self due complexification of, for example, the EMPO tensor, or the same way, a Weyl tensor, the duality is against Hodge due. So if you take another Hodge due of this whole thing, you get something like minus I times the thing itself. And the self-dual part is the opposite, yeah, plus I times the self. And then this guy would map into a spinner through the solar forms that looks like this. So this is just a trivial spinner metric. This guy is a symmetric two spinner. And the self-dual part maps to this one. And the whole thing is just just complex conjugation added together, so F comes out real. So once you do this, you have the EM field tensor's spinner counterpart, and you have the Weyl curvature tensor's spinner counterpart. And because spinners are operating over complex field, which is closed, so you can always factorize these things. So this guy factorized into two spinners, like that. And these guys are called the principal spinners. So they're the square root of the principal null directions of the F tensor. When you have a null solution, as I said, the two principal null directions are identical, which just means these two are proportional to each other. Similarly, these guys, the factors of the Weyl curvature spinner, they're the square root of the principal null directions, which is denoted gravity, PDN, PNDs, and the EM one is called EPNDs here. And then the whole space-time scattering term just becomes what's on the top line. You just have like a whole bunch of combinatoric of different terms contracting with each other. So the funny thing about spinners is, of course, they contract, when they contract with themselves, they vanish. So if, for example, this guy, is coincident with one of these guys, then one of the terms above would just vanish. And if for the null solution, like these two are identical, and you're in an algebraically special space-time, so a lot of this are equal to each other, then there's a lot of chance for terms to vanish. And so the scattering term simplifies significantly. In particular, three of these guys, or four of them, are equal, and you have these two equal, then the combinatorics works out that there's no terms left, which means if you have for example, a gravitational wave, just propagating this way, and you have EM wave propagating in exactly the same direction, for example, in the EM counterpart to a gravitational wave signal, multi-messenger stuff, then the EM wave is not actually scattered at all, which makes life a little easier, I guess.
So you have two gravitational waves propagating in the same direction, and you're saying they're not scattered?
So two gravitational waves, probably, yes, but this one is only for EM.
What does the spinner formalism buy you with a simple Newman Penrose? Is there any significance?
So they're effectively the same thing. So it's just like when you complexify your space time, then they're exactly the same thing is just the mapping through that sigma, which is just SU2 generators. They're constant. They're not dynamic anymore. It's just like save you a lot of writing. Yeah, yeah, but you can do that. You can do it. It's Newman parameters. It, yeah, it's effectively the same thing. So the solution that Brendan, Grella, and Jacobson was looking at is not in type 3 or type N. It is in type D. It's a curve background. So you have two of the principal null directions of space-time being identical and the same as your EM's propagation direction, which is the top one there. We denote that direction as O tilde. And the other two is denoted iota tilde. And this forms a dyad. And as I said, the dyad maps to a Newman Penrose tetrad. In this case, it's basically the Kinnersley tetrad. And the scattering is, there's only one term left in the scattering. And it's this term, which is psi 2. You can see the, so this is the wave component of the EM tensor multiplying onto the background curvature. So you can see, yeah, it's a scattering term. But the scattering term contains only O tilde, no iota tilde, which is very nice because when you want to have a Coulomb background or oppositely moving component in your EM wave that enters through the whole EM spinner through this expression, so they need iota to be able to pick up some correct indices. The scattering term that doesn't have it is good for preserving the purity of the wave. And also, right now you have an equation which has the wave operator operating on F equals something times F. So you can think, it's obvious that a hint that there might be some tricks you can do to absorb the scattering term into a redefinition of F. So you have wave operator operating on something that doesn't scatter at all. And in a if it's not F, if it's a scalar instead of a tensor, then this is very trivial. This is just a conformal transformation because wave operator minus 1/6 of the Ricci scalar is a conformally invariant wave operator. So you just need to change your metric so that you pick up a Ricci scalar that equals basically psi 2. So for the tensor, it's more complicated. I don't have an explicit expression, but it works the same way. And then what happens is the scattering, instead of changing the direction of the wave, it just manifests as a multiplicative factor that modulizes the wave's wave front, basically. So if you have a plane wave, a true plane wave, you know, the wavefront is usually just carried along invariantly along the propagation direction. But for this waves, for the FFV waves, so this red line is the propagation direction. The blue contour is b squared. It's a single value of b squared. So you can see there's the modulation. It's not like a monotonically changing thing or constant. It's a terrible feature. So. So this is Grella Jacobson's null solution. It's plotting it in a very awkward way. and the black lines are the B field lines. So now we get a hint that the principal null directions like behave like flatter directions of space-time. Like if you travel in it, it doesn't scatter you. So you can actually go slightly further and build a direct analogy with the second fundamental form of a surface immersed in a higher dimensional ambient. For example, let M be that surface, N be a three-dimensional ambient. And the second fundamental form is basically the shape operator S, which is, you know, the derivative of the Gauss map or well, it's basically extrinsic curvature. And then, when you have a surface, you try to approximate the surface at a point using a quadratic function, then the second fundamental form's entry is basically the coefficients of your quadratic terms. And then on the surface, you can have a tangent On that tangent, you can develop that thing into a geodesic of surface, not an n-beam. And then this guy would have a curvature, obviously extrinsic curvature, and that is just given by contracting with the second fundamental form twice the tangent, and then just normalize it. And the eigenvectors of the second fundamental form are called the principal directions. The eigenvalues, the principal curvatures, the asymptotic directions are defined to be those that when you're twice contracting with the second fundamental form, it vanishes. So the asymptotic directions are flat. Asymptotic direction. So it's the direction if you contract with the second fundamental form twice, it vanishes. I have no idea. Yeah, I have no. I guess it's so if you cut a hyperboloidal surface. Oh, let's do this. Yeah, I guess if you cut it into a shape that's actually a hyperbola, then these lines would be in the asymptotic directions. Yeah. So these are the examples of asymptotic directions, the principal directions. So this is the hyperboloid surface. And you have the principal directions being the black lines. The asymptotic directions are the red lines. And because the asymptotic directions is always symmetrically distributed against two sides of the a principal direction. So if two asymptotic directions are coincident, that means that principal direction has to be flat. You have one principal curvature vanishing, which means your whole curvature tensor has one component just died, so it's flatter. This is already looking very similar to Petrov classification, obviously. So Petrov classification basically means that algebraically more special spacetimes are more flat in the sense that you have components of the wild curvature tensor missing. It doesn't necessarily mean overall curvature value is smaller. So how do we build the analogy? Because second fundamental form has two indices, wild curvature tensor has four. So obviously you want them to operate on two index objects like two forms instead of on vectors. And two forms obviously area forms. And then so if you have a space-time, you pick one point, in the tangent space of that point, you can have a two-form, which is an area form, and you geodetically develop that thing into a two-dimensional surface, that's called a section. And the sectional curvature is the Gauss curvature of that surface. And in the Lorentzian metric signature, you have time-like sections, which just act the null cone in two null directions. And then you would have the orthogonal space-like one, space-like section. And actually, these two sections would share the same sectional curvature, which is easy to prove mathematically using just some Hodge gymnastics. So if you have a Newman-Perron's null tetrad, use these two as two of the null bases, and then the remaining spatial directions would just span the other one. So you have this relationship of a pair of sections with a tetrad. So the fact that they share the same sectional curvature means that we can actually combine the two into one giant thing, which is called, I'll call them the complex sections, which is just the time-like one plus I times space-like one. And the last thing is itself anti-self dual, because the Hodge dual is just swapping the two, and then it maps onto a two spinner, just like the EM field tensor. And then the complex sectional curvature is actually just the twice contraction of your section spinner, which is like the tangent to your surface instead of tangent to a line in the second fundamental form case. And then the real part of this thing is just the usual sectional curvature, the Gauss curvature. The imaginary part is not an intrinsic curvature of the surface because it's two-dimensional, only has one intrinsic curvature. that chi thing is part of the extrinsic curvature, but it's shared between the two surfaces as well. I won't go into details, but once again, we have this combinatorics game. So if your sections are spanned by principal null directions, the red and blue lines, the red and black curves, then that phi thing, then this psi and zeta would match one of the alphas, and then you have a bunch of terms vanishing, and then if you have like type 3 or type 4 space-time, the entire thing vanishes. Your section is actually completely flat, but otherwise it would just be in a combinatorics point of view, flatness in sense of stuff missing, components missing. So that's the principle null directions. So there are the asymptotic directions. What are the true principle ones? So we have used this spinner due to the wild curvature tensor as basically a map within the two spinner space. So it's an isomorphism in that space. So you can write it as a matrix. It's 3 by 3 dimensional because we're in 4-dimensional space time. So take 4 bases, do the combine 2 of them into a basis, and then to a section basis, and you have 6 of them. Complexify by 3. And then the entries in that matrix is just the Newman parallel scalars. Obviously, in a particular tetrad, that's related to the basis you choose for this bi-spinner space. So there's 3 sets of eigenvi-spinners, because it's 3 by 3 matrix, each factorized into 2 principal spinners, as they always do. And this forms a dyad and maps into 2 null vectors, and you can construct a null tetrad using that thing. And then each of these 3 sets gives you a pair of sections, one space-like, one time-like. And so there are 6 special sections, and they intersect into 4 lines. And the 4 lines are orthogonal to each other. You can build an orthonormal tetrad out of it, and that will be very special for your space-time. It can be very important. And then obviously you can also regard the 6 original null directions as your principal directions, in which case you can plot both these guys and the old principal null directions on the celestial sphere like this. This is just a slice of the null cone, just cut it here. Yeah. Right, so the 4 tetrad basis is when you, so it works like this. So with each bi-spinner, you have 2 factors, and you have 1, so you have 2 null directions, and then you have 3 eigen bi-spinners, so you have 6 of these guys, and then they span some sections. And these sections, when they intersect into the 4 lines. Yeah. So there are 6 of them and 4 principal null directions. The 4 principal null directions form the vertices of a diaphanoid, which is just a tetrahedron with opposite edges being equal to each other. And then if you link the midpoint of this edges, and then draw a line. They intersect the sphere at 2 points, and these 2 points would be your true principal directions, the ones that came out of the eigen bi spinners. So as you can see, the principal null directions are always symmetrically distributed against any true principal direction, just like in the surface case. We've shown what principal null directions are more like, but the true principal directions are hardly utilized at all.
So can you just remind me again, so what's the difference between a true principal direction versus just the GVND?
The GVND is actually the asymptotic directions in that language. So
yes, you're not assuming like
No, this is just generically, that's the. And then when you have specialized space-time, it just means the asymptotes become identified, and then squeezing one of the principal directions to be flat too. And then once you travel in that direction, it's basically extremely flat, which is why you can always solve stuff in there. But the result is very difficult to generalize to generic space-time because you're effectively doing like Minkowski calculations. So one particular use for this true principal directions is for wave extraction. So wave itself is a component of a wild tensor, psi 4. So obviously being a component depends on how you do the decomposition. So the basis is very important, the tetrad that you use. You want your tetrad to be optimally compatible with Peeling theorem, which underlies the whole definition of gravitational waves. So what's Peeling theorem? If assume the tetrad is already compatible with it, then the different Newman parallel scalars drop off at different rates. That tau, you can think of it as a affine parameter along an algebraic going to non-infinity. Then psi 4 drops the slowest, psi 0 drops the fastest. And you can expand, for example, psi 4 into a power series where the leading order term coefficient, the psi 4 1, is what we call the gravitational wave at infinity. So there's one pedagogical point is that people usually say that gravitational wave is well defined on squared plus, which is not true. So squared plus is flat in physical spacetime because it's asymptotically flat. it's actually type one in conformal space. So this coefficients, the leading order coefficients in all of the sides 0 to psi 4, they are the components of the conformal wild curvature tensor in the conformal space, which in general don't vanish at all, and you have a type one spacetime. So how is gravitational wave actually defined? It's defined still in a kind of a expansion point of view. If you walk slightly off square plus, then in the physical space, psi 4 dominates over the others because it only has one tau in the bottom. And obviously, if you define it as expansion parameter coefficients, then the expansion parameter gives you a lot of freedom. And it should give you that freedom because 1 over that expansion parameter is basically used as a conformal factor that you use to compactify your spacetime. And if your psi 4 1 is the conformal psi 4 for the conformal curvature tensor, then it obviously has to depend on how you can compactify the spacetime. So numerically, when people extract waves, what you do is basically on the interior of the computational domain, ideally shoot a null geodesic towards infinity and then just sample psi 4 on this null geodesic. And then you get a curve of psi 4 and then you try to fit it with the power law series on the last slide. So the problem with that thing is, the higher order coefficients, these guys, they don't matter asymptotically, but they mess up your fitting because you only have a section of a fast moving polynomial. Then you add one extra term, all the coefficients will shuffle really quickly, and then you can still fit the section you have. But what's outside of the section, which is where square plus is, things changes a lot. So you basically want your tetrad to be such that there's no spurious higher order coefficients just hanging around, messing up. So how does this higher order coefficients come from? So we have to review how the Peeling theorem is derived. So first of all, recall that when you have algebraic speciality, you have flatter spacetime. So Peeling theorem is basically just saying if you have a generic middle and you impose artificially an asymptotic flatness condition, then in between there's a smooth transition of more and more flat regions. But this picture I lifted from Penrose's book Spinners and Spacetime is actually misleading in the sense that your principal null direction don't actually do this. They don't have, so if you have like a curve spacetime, you have a wave perturbation on it, then no place would you expect like three of the principal non-directions are aligned that well, the other one sticking out, which is like a longitudinal wave. So what actually happens is like this. So all four of them move together towards one direction. So yeah, you don't have a clean separation of different different algebraic specialities at different locations. This is what actually happens in the simulation. This is equal mass non-spinning. You shoot an algeodesic. You sample the principal null directions on it. And then you represent them as different colored points on the sphere. The darker color means further along the geodesic, and also the arrow. So you can see all these points just moving uniformly towards the direction of the geodesic. So we have the Peeling theorem in terms of closeness of the principal null directions. How does that translate into the fall-off rates of size, Newman power scalars? So the property of the null vectors is if two null vectors are very close to each other, then the inner product of them is small. If they're identical, then it vanishes. So you can measure the closeness of your principal null directions by simply taking mutual products of them and then multiply them all together as a geometric sum. Or instead, you can provide a reference in the middle of the bunch of principal null directions. So you have the four principal null directions, and this reference is usually taken to be your null tetrad base, outgoing null tetrad base. And then you take the inner product of the principal null directions against this reference, and then multiply these results together. That gives you also a measure. And the Peeling theorem now just translates into, as you go further along the geodesic, this inner product becomes smaller. And in terms of Newman power scalars, their definition is basically the multiplication of the wild curvature spinner with different numbers of this reference direction. This iota thing is the n direction pointing in some random direction, which is not small. So obviously, more contractions, this guy's factored into principal null directions. So more factors, more quicker drop-off rate. Now, it becomes clear what we want our L to do. Our reference. First of all, it has to stay in between the principal null direction. If it sticks out here, then it's not a good measure, and the null Peeling theorem just doesn't work at all. If you, for example, if in the curved space, I'm just swapped L in your Kinnersley tetrad, then psi zero drop off at 1/r. So if they stay in the middle, then eventually the tetrad will be good enough. The Peeling is always going to work, so the leading order coefficient is there. However, if this guy has a motion within this bunch, and that motion has nothing to do with the principal null directions, it's just your choice of tetrad, it has this freedom, then this enters into the higher order coefficients in your Peeling theorem. So you basically want to avoid that. You want to tie this thing in the middle, and obviously from the Dice finite figure, the true principal direction is by definition in the middle, because both it and the principal null directions come from the same characteristic structure. So it's by definition ideally suited for this purpose. Right, asymptotic directions?
Yeah.
Right, so on the surface, recall that you have this No, the asymptotic direction is what's the old principal null direction, the GP and Ds.
So what's
where is my figure? So I can't find my surface figure. Here it is. So the true principal directions are these guys.
So
the black. Oh, wow, okay. Wow. The true principle directions. So the exactly that the yeah, so they're basically the maximum and minimum curvature directions. Right. Well, we're truly in Canada. Okay, so now it's clear that you should choose your tetrahedrons just to be in the true principal directions when you do extraction. And there's some slight complications that you can deal with. I wouldn't go into details of. Another problem is the this higher order coefficients is the path you take to go to infinity, the now geodesic. Asymptotically, the geodesic that goes to the same location on square paths, they're all parallel to each other. But inside, near the source region, near the strong gravity region, they're crazy different geodesics. And if your geodesic, when you're still inside the computational domain where you're trying to extract psi 4 with, trying to do the extrapolation with, is not in a wave propagation direction, you would obviously cut across sideways across the wavefront. So it samples, so your psi 4 variation samples the just samples the wavefront. It has absolutely nothing to do with Peeling theorem, which obviously enters into the higher order terms, because when you go far away enough, this little angle goes to zero, so the difference between different geodesics vanish. So from the discussion of the the principal null directions and the so asymptotically, you're guaranteed that your true principal direction is in the middle of the principal null directions, and because the principal null directions in a type n pure wave space time is in the propagation direction, that means your asymptotically, your principal true principal direction has to be in the wave propagation direction. So asymptotically, you're always good if you use this direction. It turns out, even in the near zone, this guy is actually in the correct wave propagation direction too. So in the sense that, obviously, you don't have a clean phase front, it's in a nonlinear theory. So, but you can define this Bell-Robinson vector, which is basically a GR counterpart to Poynting vector. And you can calculate energy flow as the integral of this guy. There's actual complication of an additional time integral, but let's ignore that for now. And then if you have a tetrahedron with two of the directions, the null directions in this true principal directions, then the projection of this true principal direction onto your spatial slice will be in the Bell-Robinson vector direction. So that tetrahedron is always pointing towards the correct propagation direction, which is not exactly surprising, I guess, because, the whole curvature tensor determines, both gives you the wave and the waves surrounding background of which direction is propagating. So you can extract this information from the curvature tensor itself. It's not a big surprise. If you want to get rid of the higher power coefficients, my preference is just to use the integral curves of this true principal direction.
Is there something to point the true principal direction as sort of maximize you can choose your null tetrahedron so as to maximize or minimize some of the size? Is there how you think about it like that?
So it's not so much maximizing, minimizing, but it sets some of them to zero.
Okay.
So, right. Okay. So this is the expression of this wild curvature spinner in any tetrahedron, And if you set psi 1 and psi 3 equals 0, this guy dies. This guy dies. And if you set psi 0 equals psi 4, then this off-diagonal one also dies, and you diagnose the whole thing. And this is what Penrose calls a canonical transverse tetrad. And its two null vector directions will be the true principal directions. This one has a problem though. This is in a type n space time, this guy, the observer that's associated with the tetrad, so tetrad L plus n gives you a time lag vector, and that time lag vector can be seen as the word line of an observer. That observer is following the wavefront, traveling at null speed. so it doesn't measure any gravitational wave. This is the complication I was talking about, but you can't do a transformation, you can do a boost of the slow him down and just tether him to the source using some geometric coordinates. Right. No. So when you are far away, there's only psi 4 left. So it's just like the energy only goes outwards. In the so-called canonical tetrad, they would have the same dependence because you set them to be equal. That's why you don't measure any gravitational waves when you're far away. You're trying to boost yourself infinitely towards that direction. The wave is going that way. You're trying to chase up the wave. You're trying to see an eco reverse wave going your way too. You just keep going along that wave and try to see the reverse, and then you catch up with the wave and you see nothing either this way or that way, and you're happy. That's that's what that tetrad does. But
so this looks to me like outgoing
flux. Yeah.
And you're saying,
which is kind of nice, and the flux is in the right direction that the tetrad points you to. Right, so the canonical tetrad, although the guy is following the wavefront, it is following the wavefront in the right direction. So direction is okay, you just need to slow him down for the wave extraction to work. But, so, do you guys have a lot of questions or no? Okay, I'll just follow. Another thing is, so we saw the use for the principal directions, and there's also their cousins, the principal curvatures, and these guys are just basically the eigenvalues of that matrix I showed earlier. And they're obviously true scalars, not like psi 4. Psi 4 has the spin weight, so it can't be a possible true scalar. Being true scalars, they are gauge invariant. So if you plot these guys, you can actually, in a numerical simulation, for example, you can study the geometry in a gauge invariant manner. Being the eigenvalues, they obviously satisfy the characteristic equation for the matrix itself. And the coefficients of that thing is they are the curvature invariants, which is defined here. Of the matrix, so the true
right.
So it's a matrix operating on bivector space, and then the eigenvectors, eigenvalues of that, right? So you can plot either directly this guy's the eigenvalues or the coefficients of the characteristic equation. They're basically the same thing. They're related quite simply. And then you can use this guy to study things like, excuse me. Like the transition from the in-spiral to quasi-normal ring-down phase of a binary black hole merger. So there is a slight mystery that how does this transition occur, because the electric and magnetic parity, positive and negative parity, quasi-normal modes, they share the same frequency because they have the same potential in the Tarkovsky equation. But during the in-spiral phase, the magnetic parity one is generated by current quadrupole, the electric parity is generated by the mass quadrupole, and they generally have different frequencies. Mass quadrupole is just twice the orbital frequency. Current quadrupole is the orbital frequency plus the spin precession frequency. And spin precession frequency doesn't have to be equal to the orbital one. And then you can do calculations like PN calculations or do the geodesic transport in a perturbation theory to calculate the precession frequency. And that thing is a monotonic function of the separation of the two black holes. So as two black holes get closer, there's a chance for the precession frequency to actually match the orbital frequency. But that's a momentary coincidence. That's not a locking. So you go further, they lock again. So if nothing else happens, that just means the ring down phase has to happen at a sharp point where this happens exactly. And this particular the spin precession frequency does not actually depend on the spin magnitude. So infinitesimal spins would determine when the ring down occur. So it doesn't make much sense. So what turns out actually, it looks like, the orbital motion provides a energetically favorable location for the spins to be in through the spin orbit coupling terms, for example, in PN calculations, you have potential. And then the radiation reaction will push the spins into that favorable position. And then in the center of mass frame, this position is in either aligned or anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum. So the current quadrupole is actually killed in that frame. So the consistency between two frequencies is achieved by default. And in another frame, in a boosted frame, you have a fake magnetic parity mode just because the frame transformation, and it doesn't do anything physical. For example, the black hole kicks. You can see it as interference between the mass quadrupole and the current quadrupole. It's like EM, if you have a mass magnetic dipole and the electric dipole, you put them 90 degrees against each other. Then the radiation constructively interfere on one side, destructively interfere on the other, and you have a kick for your entire system for momentum conservation. You have the same thing in GR. And then once the quasi-normal ring down happens, you don't have this independent mass quadrupole, current quadrupole contribution anymore. So your kick just stops. So I actually plotted the acceleration of the black hole as a function of time. It looks like this. So this is merger. So this is flat zero. There's actually a pretty sharp transition into quasi-normal ring down, which is kind of interesting. So I'm not exactly sure of this yet. So I haven't published this thing because earlier there were works using wave extraction that shows the kick continues all the way into ring down. But that's obviously, as you have seen, wave extraction is very dodgy business. In particular, when you do when you calculate the flux on a sphere, if you shift the zeta coordinates, all of them just shift that way, then your calculated flux will be pointed in one particular direction, even though there's no bias in any direction. And this thing doesn't extrapolate away because the zeta extends all the way to infinity. So I'm currently working on a cleaner extraction method that shows that. And in terms of using this, guys, right, we only have 3 minutes, so I'll just show some pictures. So this lovely picture. So these are not the curvatures, not the lambdas themselves. They're the lambdas of the projection of the wild curvature tensor into a spatial slice. You can use that one in exactly the same way. But current quadrupole symmetry is such that if you combine the current quadrupole with the with the angle, total angular momentum, which is a current dipole, then you have this skew reflection asymmetry. So if you do a reflection against the equatorial plane and you rotate this guy by 90 degrees, then you get the oppositely colored stuff. The mass quadrupole and the current dipole has this reflection symmetry, anti-symmetry, which is doesn't really need much explaining. And if you combine the two, so the angle between these little ears is like in between 0 and 1/2 pi, and then there's no good symmetry against the equatorial plane. So using this, you can track how much current quadrupole is in your system in a very easy way. You can plot this thing for actual simulation. At the earlier time, you have this ear sticking out different angles. Later time, they become more aligned, and the reflection symmetry against the equatorial plane improves. So you can see there's actually a decline of the current quadrupole moment as compared to the mass quadrupole moment. For contrast, if you do this for a simulation where there's no current quadrupole throughout, your spin's always anti-aligned with the total angular momentum, then right from the start, you have a perfect alignment and perfect reflection anti-symmetry. So yeah, it's just nice pictures, really. I want to show. I chose the color scheme very carefully. And lastly, so the true principal directions, I haven't done any work on this direction yet, but one of the most important things in surface theory is the integral curves of the principal curvature, principal directions. They're called the curvature curves. And they have these critical points called umbilics, barbu and umbilics. And they have to satisfy certain theorems like Poincaré-Hopf and stuff like that. So the number of them and their pattern around them is related to the overall topology of the shape. So as you can see, at each point, these lines give you the local geometry, which surface it looks like. And globally, this critical structure of these lines gives you the global structure. So obviously, in gravity, this might be interesting to study the, for example, if you perturb a space-time, you can describe the perturbation as highly degenerate single critical point breaking into a whole bunch of different ones. And what kind of, there are constraints on what kind of small ones you can form, you can have, and then the how they scatter. So you basically have a generic description of the perturbation of any exact solutions, say cosmology. But that's just a very initial thought. It hasn't been done yet. Right, I think it's spot on too. Yes. Oops, sorry. All right, thank you for listening.